All right, you're on the Arms Room Show with Glenn
and Drew,
and we are excited always to be here talking to you guys. Thanks to all of our patrons for the support that you give to the show. Arms Room shirts have finally arrived.
I know. I finally have an Arms Room shirt now.
I know. Drew finally got her Arms Room shirt, and they have finally arrived. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take the shirts. We're going to put them up on the Independence Training web store. We're going to put a post up on the all the social media stuff for the Arms Room as well. And we're going to put them up to you guys can see with the photos of the different color variations that we got. Whichever ones are the most popular, those are the ones we'll order in. And we've got a handful of ones already ready to go. Patrons, you guys are going to get a discount code. Our $10 and above patrons are going to get one discount code. All of our other patrons are going to get another discount code so that you guys can go order a shirt at a discounted price. And then everyone else will obviously pay full price. And then whichever ones are the most popular, those are the ones we'll order back in. But we've got a couple different combinations. Right now they're all the two-color, three-quarter sleeve baseball shirts because we fucking like them.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the ordering.
Mm-hmm.
So they're pretty awesome. I like them a lot. Logo on the front's bigger than it's ever been. I don't know if I like how big it is.
It is big.
It's really big.
It is big.
I liked it maybe better when it was smaller, yeah. But I don't know.
We'll see.
We'll see what happens.
We'll wear them this weekend.
And then they've got the Sabretooth on the back, of course, which looks great. So anyways, we got that going on. Extra show for May for our patrons. Jiminy Christmas. Drew, it's already damn near the end of May.
I know.
And we got to do our May extra show. So we have not done the May extra show. We'll be doing that next week as we'll be back in the office quite a bit. So next week we'll be doing that extra show. Feedback from the anger management show. Wow.
Wow. Overwhelming feedback.
Wow. Thank you.
I mean, immediately we started getting feedback.
Same day.
Like maybe 2 hours after we posted the episode.
And we've been getting it.
Constantly.
So, first of all, I want to say thank you to everyone who sent us a message. Some of you guys called us,
mm-hmm.
even, which
left
was
voicemail.
Awesome.
Yeah.
We got some really strong feedback, positive feedback on that episode.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much for everyone who sent us a message. We love that kind of stuff. I mean, honestly, man, we sit in this room and we talk into these microphones, and we don't always know who's actually hearing us. So if you're really hearing us, and I mean hearing us, and you've got something to say, agree, disagree, we don't care, right? You want to add something to something we've said, you're a subject matter expert and on something we talk about, and you're like, oh, man, they really missed this point. Like, dude, hit us up and let us know. We're happy to hear about it. You know, we'd love to hear about what you have to say. So please make sure you send us messages. And in that vein, the Anger Management Show was kind of more in line with the $10 and above patron shows. So if you really liked that show and you're not a $10 above patron, or you are a $10 above patron and you haven't been listening to the extra shows, you're missing out on maybe what I think could be our best content.
Mm-hmm.
We have some pretty incredible shows in the extra shows just because we get really personal, kind of like we did last week.
Yeah.
And so thank you to everyone who was vulnerable and honest enough to email us and text us and even call us. I've done, I don't know, a half a dozen actual phone calls with people
and
voicemails. And
I think you even handed out Annette's name and number again.
I did. Yeah, I handed out my counselor's information to several people. I mean, a half a dozen more maybe. So thank you to all of you guys who were listening to the show and were like, wow, that was awesome, and got back to us about it. We're happy to continue to do those kinds of programs, you know. And if you have other show ideas, other stuff you want us to talk about in that topic, man, hit us up and let us know. We're happy to talk about it. You guys are our patrons, so you're the listeners, man. Freaking send us your show ideas, info@trainingaz.com. And you guys are, you know, kind of to say you're welcome to a lot of you guys who said thank you for being so honest from our end. You know, you're welcome. We traveled some hard roads, man. We're not perfect. We're not perfect. We've made a lot of mistakes. We've had to learn a lot of lessons. So, you know, and we're still learning, and we're still changing, and we're still growing and developing. And I hope that the stuff we continue to say means something to you guys. So with that being said, fuel shortage, people putting fuel in trash cans and trash bags and fucking Burger King garbage cups. Just unreal. Gosh. I just look around at people and I'm like, between these people putting trash in garbage bag, or I'm sorry, gas in garbage bags, and fucking people still wearing masks and validating, oh, I don't want to look like a Republican or conservative, or oh, I don't trust the CDC to take it off. Well, you trusted them to put it on, right? It's like all these people, I look around and I'm just like, Thanos, where you at? You know, like
trying to snap.
We're gonna lose some good eggs, man. You know what I mean? We lost Spider-Man in the movie. That really sucked.
He came back.
But we fucking kept Iron Man. You know what I mean? Like, we're gonna lose a few good eggs, but we're also gonna keep some good ones. And just saying, Captain America didn't die. Right? I don't know. Oh, it's just unreal. Look, man, don't panic. Okay? If you're in an area affected, that really sucks. We're affected just right now in Arizona by the prices going up. No one's panic bought yet, but man, don't let the fear and the media drive your decisions.
Yeah.
You know, do not let them drive your decisions, guys. That's no bueno. Mm-hmm. That's really it for news, man. There's been some shootings. There was a guy in an apartment complex who smoked a...
I was just reading that right before we started this.
Yeah, he smoked a dude who was shooting people and trying to get them to leave their apartment so he could shoot them, and another dude propped up his fucking hunting rifle and fucking iced him through the window or whatever, but... Kudos to that dude. There's been some other crazy shootings. There was a shooting I was reading about this morning and on a freeway somewhere. Some little kid got hurt. Something. I don't know. The world's a crazy place.
It is a crazy place.
Stay strapped or get clapped. Roll with your freaking medical kit. Roll with your gear. Yeah. Take whatever you can, wherever you can. Whatever tools you can carry with you, carry them.
Yep.
Keep them handy. The world is what it is, and not changing anytime soon. All right, Redwire gear moment. Changes in the weather means it's time to check your gear. Mm-hmm. For some of us, it's already gotten incredibly hot. For some of you, it's getting hot. Check your equipment. Everything that could possibly be affected. Stuff outside your house. Stuff in your EDC pack. Stuff in your vehicle. The exposure of outdoor tools and equipment to the weather, fluids in your vehicle engine, your air conditioning unit, whatever, man, your clothing, whatever. Just for a second, sit down and think, all right, it's going to get hotter. For some of you guys, it's going to get more humid. What's going to be affected by this change in weather? And then start with those items. And as you work on those, you'll discover more.
Yeah.
Don't wait until you need your gear to realize that it's all screwed up. Mm-hmm. Weather's changing. It's getting hotter again.
Especially in
check your gear.
Your vehicle, if you carry med supplies in your vehicle, check it. Make sure it doesn't melt because it's Arizona. If you're in Arizona.
Decompose.
If there's anything that – I know for me, I always have to check it because something melts. Something inevitably. Bust open because
it's sticky.
Too hot. Yeah, like my running pack, my med kit that hangs on the back of my headrest. That thing is so stained and is so disgustingly dirty and everything else. So check all that.
Redwire Gear brought to you by Redwire Gear Moment. Excuse me. Brought to you by RedwireGear.com. All right. Our topic today, sent in by one of our listeners and students, kind of a general outline. We're going to hit most of the topics. I don't know if we'll get to them all, but just kind of talking about overall what we're going to refer to as tactical paradigm shifts. All right. Things that have drastically changed over, you know, the last so many years. And to kind of start this off, I'll say this. A lot of times, when people, in fact, let me back up. I was watching an Instagram account the other day, and a guy, being real honest with himself and everybody else, posted a video of him shooting like back in 2005. 2005, you know, he's hunched over, arms straight out. It looked like he had just gotten out of the service or something. Arms locked out, right? Head ducked down between his shoulders, shooting, finished his shooting, did his quick left-right situational assessment, head whip, and then jammed his gun back in his holster. And then he showed a video of him shooting, you know, this week, and he's standing straight up, arms are relaxed, wrists are relaxed, he's shooting, recoil management is better, hits are better, and, you know, then he does a real situational assessment, you know, contextual situational assessment, and then reholsters his pistol. And he was just talking about, you know, the shifts in how it's been, and like he said, kind of paraphrasing a Bruce Lee quote of be like water, right? You know, flow like water. And that's the idea, right? There's nobody in this space. Nobody. Who is still doing the same shit successfully that they were doing 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. Now, look, you could take an old school, I don't know, infantryman from World War I and bring him forward. And if he was violent back then, he's going to be capable of violence now. It's not the capacity for violence or the will to succeed or anything like that that I'm talking about. What I'm talking about are the skills and concepts that have been related to everything. And I really appreciated this guy's post. I almost reposted it on the independence training thing. I just kind of got busy and forgot. But it was a really great post because it really showed, like, look, man, we're all evolving. Our skills are changing. The techniques are changing. The concepts are changing all the time. And I really liked that he showed his own tactical paradigm shift. Like, hey, man, here's how I used to do things. And back then, this was the best we knew how. I think of, you know, when I first started getting trained by my father, then getting trained by, you know, the Army, then getting trained doing various different, you know, jobs I've had over the years and different capacities in which I've applied my skill sets and how I teach people now. While there are some similarities, of course, there are so many massively, massively huge shifts. There's these massive shifts. I mean, shit, man, in 2000, we were still teaching people basically how to fight the Russians in the Cold War. I mean, the concepts, the equipment, the Humvees, the M855 green tip, the armor that we were wearing, the helmets we were wearing, they were all very much, if you compare them to what we use today, trash. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it just wasn't what we want now. Could they still work now? Of course, applied effectively, that stuff could still work. But the point is, as we get more information, as we change, as we develop, think about how I was first taught military medicine. And then how drastically that changed very quickly. And even now, 20 years later, how things have changed that much more. How we started teaching medicine in 2009 and how we teach it today. Sure, the concepts are the same, but we're not teaching them in the same order. We're not teaching tourniquets the same way. We're not teaching needles the same way. We're not teaching chest seals the same way. We're not teaching packing the same way. We're not teaching bandaging the same way. Look, man, shit changes. And one of my most frustrating things that we butt our heads up against is people who are like, I don't need no training because, you know, I was in the Army back in 2005 or 1970 fucking six, right? And I know, I remember it. Just fucking stick a tampon in there, stop that bleeding. You know, some stupid shit like that. And you're like, man, you couldn't be more wrong. And maybe you're regurgitating some shit you heard back then, but you couldn't be more wrong about modern stuff. I mean, that's just insane to me. It's like in this world, for some reason, people get super dogmatic about what they know, and I'm sure it happens in other worlds as well, medical field and the racing field and the, you know, industrial engineering field. I'm sure people get super dogmatic about their stuff there as well. One of the things that bothers me here is how dogmatic people get. Like, dude, I'm not married to anything here. I'm not married to a concept. I'm not married to a piece of equipment. My rifle has developed. My AR-15 is not even really that close to what it was when I first got into this industry. I mean, yes, it's an AR-15, has a stock and a grip and a 16-inch barrel and a red dot optic or whatever, but it's changed. It's developed as new techniques, as new equipment, and as some of that equipment has enhanced techniques or capabilities, then obviously, of course, we switch to those things. And that's some of the things that we're going to talk about. So kind of following our outline we were sent here, and by the way, you guys ever have, you know, show ideas you want to include an outline with? Yeah, we're all about that. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about some of these basic things, right? First of all, before I even get into this, you can't be married to anything. You have to be willing to try everything.
Things are forever changing.
And you have to try it enough times that you're sure it's going to fail or you're sure it's going to work. And for me, it's a 75% ratio. It has to work or fail 75% of the time, right? So if it's working more than it's failing, I'm in. If it's failing more than it's working, I'm out. And I consider that number to be about 75%. Anything less than that, more than that, whatever, it's all that fucking gray area, right? Mm-hmm. But like for me to incorporate a tactic, a technique, a piece of equipment, whatever, I'm like about 75% of the time, pressure testing it. It should work about 75% of the time. It means if it's a fighting concept, I need to see it pressure tested under force. If it's a medical concept, I need to see it pressure tested, with live tissue or something like that. And I myself am not going to be able to do all that work because that would be very anecdotal. So once I'm looking into new concepts or technique or whatever, then I start putting it out to our people who put it out to their people who put it out to their people. And next thing you know, we've got 100+ people out there giving us feedback back on this information as we're reaching out to our networks going, hey, are you seeing this? What are you seeing? How's this thing working? And it doesn't take very long to gather enough data to say, is this valid to change or not? Does this work or not? Because just because something's new doesn't mean it's good. All right. So to get into some basic stuff, here's where we're going to go. All right. To start with this, let's just use like old school warfare mentality, right? We wore bright red or bright blue or bright yellow uniforms, and we lined up and we shot at each other with relatively semi-accurate guns, and then we took a knee or stepped to the side and reloaded while the second line came in and they fired. And then we stood there while people fired fucking cannons at us. Let me just repeat that again because to me, warfare like this seems insane. Watch a movie like The Patriot or any movie like that and it just blows my freaking mind, right? Let me say that again. They stood there while the opposing side fired cannons at them. Now, I don't know if that's huge fucking balls that those dudes had. And I don't mean cannonballs. I mean testicles, right? Or if it was just indoctrination of this is the way it's done. Now, back then, shoot, move, communicate wasn't really that big of a thing. Now, you advance into places like the Civil War as an example. Even the Revolutionary War, there were examples of a lot of our people, our side, taught by a lot by the Indians and the French even, about guerrilla warfare, and we were very effective against the British because of that. You saw the same thing in the Civil War, where the Southerners, the honkies, God bless you, were like, yeah, fuck the standing in the line shit. We're going to climb up in the trees. You know what I mean? We're going to climb in the trees and we're going to shoot you a couple times. We're going to shoot you officers first. We're not playing this civilized warfare. Like the idea of civilized warfare blows my mind. I'm like, if I'm going into war today, who's the most important guy? Let's absolutely make sure we kill him first. Let's wound all these people over here horribly so that people need to, take care of them. And also let's go over, let's psyops these motherfuckers all night long with, a giant recording of crying babies. I don't give a shit. Like, let's do some horrible shit to these people because I want to win.
Yeah.
I want to win. I don't care if people like me at the end. I'm not like, what if I need to meet for tea with my opponent? I don't want him thinking I'm an undistinguished gentleman. I'm like, if I meet with my opponent for tea, I'm going to fucking kill him. I'm going to stick a knife in his throat. Yeah. Oh, you want to meet for tea? Yeah. Whoa, we should definitely meet for tea. Yeah, just two of us. What do you say? In this remote location. it just blows my mind. Like how wars used to be fought. You watch that scene in The Patriot, right? Yeah. Where he goes in there and they're talking to Cornwallis. And this is like his number one enemy. And they're like being all proper. Well, as long as you continue. Like, pull your sword and fucking kill him. You know what I mean? Like the whole time.
Sorry for your ears, people.
It just blows my mind, But that's how it was done back then. Obviously, yeah. There's been a paradigm shift. So this is a pretty extreme example, but, an example nonetheless, right? That's kind of what we're talking about. So to kind of get a little bit more modern, okay, let's take a look at tourniquets, right?
Yeah.
Tourniquets, when I was first taught medicine, it was like tourniquets as a last resort because if you put a tourniquet on, you're going to lose the limb. Now, we know now that data was all because of outdated and poor, outdated information, poor record keeping, bad communication, political agendas, all kinds of reasons. And now we're like, ah, slap a tourniquet on it. And then someone's like, what if it's not arterial bleeding? I'm like, hey, you want to stop with fucking slap a tourniquet on it? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you might be wrong, but like, eh, you got plenty of time. Slap a tourniquet on it. You know what I mean? Like, it's better to put a tourniquet on it and be wrong than not put a tourniquet on and be wrong. So if you're scared, because all blood looks like a lot of blood if you've never seen a lot of blood. So grab a tourniquet and pow, throw it on there. Call it a day.
Do you know how long the tourniquet's been around for?
I think the first recorded use was like 1460 something.
So it says the tourniquet was first used in 200 BC and continued up to 500 AC during Roman emperors at the time, saving the life of soldiers and patients with ignorance of the limb. But who perfected it was a French surgeon.
Was that something in the 1400s or whatever?
1718.
1700s. I knew it was somewhere in that gap.
Developed a screw device and a.
It was still the 1700s? I thought it was earlier.
1718.
1718.
I mean, it's been basically around forever.
Well, remember we were in Florida and I found that pirate tourniquet?
Yeah.
Remember? We were at the pirate museum and, yeah. And I was like,
we took a picture of it.
Yeah, we took a picture. I was like, look at this. It's a fucking pirate tourniquet. From like, and that was from like the.
14.
Easily. Maybe that's 13. Where I was thinking. Yeah, it was freaking. Maybe that's the thing I was thinking in my
but
head.
This guy.
That thing was like 1400s.
Jean-Louis Petit.
And so the idea here is that's been a big shift.
Yeah.
Right?
And look at the advanced history of now where the tourniquet is. Mm-hmm. Always evolving, always changing.
The cat is on its 7th generation. The soft tee is on its 4th or 5th generation now. I mean, mm-hmm. these things are – even the equipment is constantly evolving as we find failures within the equipment. It's constantly evolving. A lot of people don't know, but some of the original cats were fucking breaking.
Yeah.
You know, but they didn't know, man. They were doing the best they could. They tested them the best they could. Then they got them out in the field, and holy shit, we had some problems with them. So they made them better. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like
– But that's like that gauze that we were discussing. Remember I don't remember who we were talking – oh, it was John when we were doing the Stop the Bleed at Garrett's office when he said he's got that stuff that you pour into –
like the old school Celox powder?
Yeah.
Or, quick clot powder?
The powder versus now it's just gauze that you jam in there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always because they always figured evolving. Out that when you pour the powder in, it gets in everybody's eyes if it's a windy day.
Or rotor wash, which is the worst, right? You got a medevac over top and it's all that brown out rotor wash is sucking all up toward the helo and it's blown in people's faces. It was creating exothermic heat, so you had literal like first responders, medics who were getting burned, trying to hold pressure on the wound with that shit inside, getting it to stay in place. So it's like, hey man, this is awesome. Granules, we pour it in the wound and ta-da, it makes the bleeding stop. Awesome. But then when we really started applying the feels, like, hold on, this isn't working. We need something different. And yet there's still people out there who are like, oh, I got an old IFAC from when I was in the Army and it's got that old powder. What's that old quick lock powder? I got that powder. Save a life. I'm like, throw that fucking shit in the trash.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like literally throw it in the garbage can. I just keep it for emergencies. No. Throw it in the fucking garbage can. By the way, if you still have some of that stuff and you want to have a fun experiment for the kids, take a Dixie cup, like a plastic cup, pour the quick clot powder in it, and then activate it with some water. It'll melt the cup. Yeah. You won't put that in your body?
No,
don't
thanks.
Do that.
Yeah, probably not a good idea. But forever changing was my point of my story.
Oh, forever changing, yeah. So there's a lot of like basic concepts here that I'm going to kind of hit one at a time just to get you guys thinking. This isn't necessarily to educate you on why everything changed, though there'll be a little bit of that mixed in here. But most of it is just to get you thinking like – it's okay to upgrade your stuff. It's okay to update your gear. It's okay to update your skill sets and consider new concepts and consider new techniques as long as you can contextualize it to you and as long as you've tested it or you can see the proof that it's been tested enough within the context you're going to be applying it to the point of it succeeds more than it fails. Things like crenellated flashlight bezels. I remember, you know, people started carrying flashlights. Everyone would joke about the DNA collectors, you know, at the edge of the flashlight, and they have tactical pens that looked like weapons. Mm-hmm. And first of all, most of that stuff's getting seized by, you know, security agencies and the TSA and all that. And second of all, the force, the benefit of the strike doesn't come from making someone bleed a superficial wound. You're not punching through to someone's heart, right? You'd be dealing some surface damage. But the benefit of the strike comes from your ability to strike, right? Like it doesn't Bruce Lee did not have spikes on his hands, and yet he rickety-tickety fucking messed people up because of the strike capability of his fists and his shins and his feet and his legs, not because he had some spikes. He was ripping people's skin up, right?
Yeah.
Mike Tyson, I mean, pick anybody who's been doing damage to people for a long time. If people aren't using spikes, other than Mike Tyson biting someone's ear off, other than that, right, you're talking about blunt force trauma. And if you want to actually appear to not be a crazy person and you want to not have your shit confiscated by security and you really don't – I don't really want the other guy's blood all over me. Like I don't want to strike someone and cut them up and have their blood all over me.
Yeah, gross.
Right? I don't want that. I don't know what's fucking in their blood. I'm not wearing latex gloves before I go into this fight or nitrile gloves before I go into this fight. Like no, man. Blunt force trauma is where it's at. So then now you see that's gone. From lights now. That's gone from the tactical pens. That's gone from strike. We're back to blunt strike items because there was a period in time where we tried it, it didn't work, and now we're out of it. But I still see some people carrying that around and they still espouse it, like, yeah, man, but I'll stick this in someone to fucking make them bleed. And I'm like, ugh, have you thought about that? And how much training do you do, by the way, to strike somebody with that thing? Because if you're not particularly good at it, it's not going to work out as well as you hoped it might.
Yeah.
You know? I kind of already mentioned this one with armor in the military, but like, you know, full on tack vests, full sized body armor, massive body armor all the way down, groin protector shield, you know, shoulder shields, neck gaiters, you know, everything, side plates, the whole bit. And there's still some organizations that are going to wear that stuff because it's contextual to them. But the average person was still out there like, yeah, man, I want to get this big old body armor, you know, flak, quote unquote, flak vest. They wanted to get like, you know, the old IOTVs or the old armor carriers. And I remember when we first as a training company, we actually had AR 500 armor produce us some miniature plate carriers and we started rocking them. And people were making fun of us. And a couple of our guys who had used these things operationally in high-tiered units were like, nah, man, this is really all you want. You just, you know, we call them spine plates. It's really just to, you know, protect your heart, protect your spine, and don't die if you get shot. But you're, you know, you're in there, you're hitting, you're, you know, hitting target fast and you're getting off target quickly. And, you know, we're only carrying a few mags. You know, we don't need all this space. We don't have to carry all this stuff. And people were like, oh my God, you get killed because I'll shoot you in the belly. I'll shoot you. I'm like, I've seen you at the range. Calm down with the fucking you picking where you're going to shoot me bullshit. All right. Yeah, maybe you do that on a paper target. But yeah, you haven't freaking done that in force on force. I know because we do force on force and people like that show up and they can't fucking anything. So, you know, and we've seen it enough times and we know it's real. But my point is that whole mentality has changed. Where now we're going back to – everyone's going back to smaller plate carriers, smaller chest rigs, micro rigs, minimalist rigs. These are all terms that are very popular in the industry now. It's like, boom, I want a chest rig that carries a couple mags and a radio or a med kit or whatever. So micro stuff, minimalist stuff. This is all very popular now. Even though it wasn't that many years ago, everyone wanted a giant Black Hawk tactical vest that carried your pistol and six mags and two frag grenades and two smoke and your hydration bladder. And
it's a lot.
All this other shit. I mean, but that's what people used to carry around. I mean, I think about old, you know, some of the old rigs or, you know, the old infantryman loadouts or any of that. It's like, wow. You know, the old assault vests and stuff like, man, that was a lot of stuff. And for some people, contextual to their job and maybe military, law enforcement, whatever, that might be needed. But most people are realizing, hey, we don't need all that shit. So that's been another big change. And along with what we put on our chest is also what we put on our legs. Things like drop leg rigs and drop leg holsters and all that have pretty much gone the way of the dinosaur. You know, I was doing a weapon retention class with a local agency. What was that, Friday? Monday? Monday.
Monday, yeah.
I went and taught some DT folks for a local agency, and we were doing – retention with different types of holsters, and there was three or four different holsters there, and so we're working different weapon retention methods, keeping the gun in the holster, et cetera. And one of the guys was like, what about drop leg holsters? And I go, if you can tell me who on your department still runs a drop leg holster, I'll show you a technique. And he looks at one of the guys who's on SWAT, and he's like, anybody? And he's like, fuck no, man. No one's wearing that. I'm like – he's like, when's the last time you saw one? I go, outside of a you know some idiot at the gun show or something. I'm like,
No, there was –
couldn't even tell you. No one in our classes – not a full drop leg. I mean, you know, a drop tine holster, like what we wear on our belts, right? That's normal
stuff. I thought one of those SWAT cops in Newport was wearing one of those drop holsters.
He might have been.
I think I remember seeing
He might have been. I think by the end of class, we tucked it up. Yeah, yeah. Okay. You were right. No, you're right. I'd forgot about that. You're right.
I remember that because I
remember. He did. And because he was running, and I'm like, get the fuck over here, man. You look like a clown. Come over here. And we remember we pulled the top strap off, and then I put it on. He's like, that's so much better. And I'm like.
And he's like, it's more comfortable.
Yeah, dude, 2021, man. What's wrong with you?
I was going to say.
No, you're right. I've forgotten about that guy. So, yeah. So, other than that guy and some dude I saw at a gun show or whatever, nobody else is wearing it. And that's because, you know, they have their place, like doing a lot of vehicle work from the military standpoint. You know, I saw a lot of guys wear them on their legs, and then they'd want to rotate them up on top of their legs while they were driving because it would give them clean access to a pistol, which was better for fighting inside of a Humvee. A military Humvee gets very crowded very quickly because there's comms equipment, reload equipment, a fucking turret gunner who's shits all over the place and stuff hanging down and cables and cords and everything else. And it's like it's already – it's not a civilian Humvee, you know, and so a military Humvee doesn't have a lot of space. And so a lot of guys considered like, hey, man, if I'm going to have to fight out of this car, this vehicle, it's probably going to be a freaking pistol-related situation. And deploying a rifle from there isn't going to be as easy, you know. So we saw a lot of that kind of stuff. But, you know, other than that, I mean, those are kind of things that, you know, they came and went. Mm-hmm. Big, giant rigs on people's legs. I still have one that I use for competition purposes. But outside of that, like, you know, I used to see people carrying ammo on their legs. You know, they have a little drop leg rig and lots of ammo. That kind of shit's gone away too.
Yeah.
You know, it's just as equipment develops and people realize like, there's better methods, man, for getting in and out of vehicles and going through tight objects. I mean, there's better methods than this. You know, even the idea of going back to the vest where these giant vests with 18 magazines up front where you can't get into them, like that's gone away. On that note, like helmets. I mean, ballistic helmets used to be the thing. Like, if you were going to have a helmet, it was going to be a ballistic helmet. Nowadays, I mean, we all wear plastic bump helmets. Mm-hmm. It's a lighter weight, less neck pain, less, you know, there's guys I've known who wore ballistic helmets, you know, an entire career and literally ended up doing, you know, two or three neck surgeries because of just how much, you know, wearing helmets and night vision and having, you know, long-term problems because of the weight. And the realization that those things do protect you and you've got that, you know, Saving Private Ryan moment or whatever where the bullet glances off the guy's helmet or whatever. Like, yeah, that kind of stuff does happen. And there's plenty of stories come back from Iraq and Afghanistan where, you know, the bullet went in the helmet and zipped around and popped out the back, where there's plenty of those. That there's no doubt about it. So, again, contextual to your environment, a ballistic helmet may still be beneficial. But for most people out there running, you know, night vision and doing quick hits, you know, depending on what agency organization they're working with, light and fast is going to beat, you know, the tactical turtle mentality every day. So lightweight, you know, now we have these high cut, you know, they're cut for ear pro, they're cut for communications, they have rails on them for lights. I mean, I remember the first ballistic helmet I put on my head. First of all, I have a small head, sort of. I have a weird fucking shaped head. And when I put a helmet on my, I look like a fucking idiot. So I didn't like the old ballistic helmets anyway because they were like so big. I never could get one that was like totally fit me, and I hated it. And I was never really into the helmet concepts, like wear it as little as possible. And we have a ballistic helmet now. I have one in the safe. How many times have you seen me wear it?
None.
It's fucking exactly. I have a really, really nice one. It's a modern one. It's a high cut. It's very, very nice. Very, very nice ballistic helmet. Never wear it. It's like, fuck this thing. But obviously I'm wearing my other gear all the time. You know, I'm wearing, you know, our ballistic helmets all the time because contextually that works for me. And those things, I mean, if you would have told me, you know, 15, 20 years ago, hey, man, you know, put this plastic helmet on, I'd be like, I don't think so. Maybe the ballistic helmet looks stupid, but at least they protect me. But now with the change in mentality and tax techniques, equipment, all of that, okay, now it makes more sense.
Yeah.
Kind of looking at some of these other ideas.
Remember, we were watching Stranger Things last night. Remember, they had those mag lights, like,
oh, taped yeah, onto yeah, the, they had them like the mounted rifles on the top of the MP5s, which used to be a thing.
Yeah,
that was a legit freaking thing. That's right.
Yeah, we were talking about that last night too.
Big
ass long mag lights.
Yeah, like, you know, 4D mag lights or whatever. But now you see also, you know, a huge shift in techniques, things like pistol fighting. Mm-hmm. Fighting with a pistol, grappling and fighting with a pistol now is something we focus on heavily. And it's in almost all of our programs, even in our basic handgun steel carry class.
Yeah.
We demo it, we describe it, and we discuss the you know, the validity of it and the context of it. 15 years ago, we weren't thinking about that kind of stuff. 20 years ago, we weren't really thinking about that kind of stuff. People like, it's a pistol, man. You know, if you're up close, whatever, stab him with a knife, punch him in the head or whatever. You know, get him fucking off of you. Yeah. And there's always been the speed rock methods and the close quarters fighting techniques. But those were all, again, based on still shooting with the pistol, not grappling with someone, getting them into a dominant position, and then fighting them with the gun. Like, that is not how we were thinking of it. The old, you know, speed rock method and other close quarters methods that we used and were taught were not – We still weren't considering that the other person had a vote, so to speak. We still weren't considering that we would be grappling or entangled with our opponents. So that's been a huge shift for sure. I'm looking at this real quick. So when it comes to pistols in general, I mean, look at the paradigm shifts we've had with pistols going from all pistols had safeties, pistols had hammers, right? We were double action to single action. Come into the striker fired world, suddenly no more safeties. Suddenly striker fired only. Suddenly no exposed hammers. Now we still have guns with safeties. We still have guns with striker fired or hammers instead of striker fired.
And now you can mount lights to your pistols. Where before it was.
That hasn't been that long either.
Yeah. Before it was just the Harry's technique and the. Other one.
Syringe. And yeah. The index. There was a couple of them, you know, FBI search technique. Mm-hmm. There were those kinds of techniques that people were using. But yeah, now you're picking, okay, we're going to put lights on these guns. Mm-hmm. And we're going to take the safeties off these guns. And we're going to go internal strikers only. And also, we're going to cram as many rounds in here. I mean, remember, look at the paradigm shift for 9mm. Semi-automatic pistols start to become popular, we'll say, in the, you know, 1980s, mm-hmm. right? The Beretta trials are held, or the military trials are held. Beretta gets the contract for the military's M9 system. It is, of course, what it is. And 9mm becomes kind of popular over 45 or 38 specials fired out of revolvers, even though 9mm and 38 special have almost the exact same thermal performance, but whatever. 9mm start getting tested and used in real-world situations, and everyone's like, oh, my God, this round is anemic. And it was. It was anemic because it hadn't really been fully developed. So, like, oh, shit, we have problems. We got to go with, you know, where's the 45? And agencies immediately switch back to 45. You know, the FBI goes in search of their thing. They're looking at the 10mm. They look at the 40 Smith & Wesson. There's all kind of politics that happen with that we don't have time for. And the 40 Smith & Wesson gets chosen, and then that goes across a nationwide thing with 40 Smith & Wesson. Everyone's like, boom, 40, man. You want to fucking put a big old hole, stop somebody in 40 calibers. It's less recoil than a 45.
And some people
But it's more stopping power than a 9mm. And it turns out none of those fucking things were true. Over time, none of that shit was true. And now there's a mass exodus away from 40 cal. Mm-hmm. DHS has left it. All the local police agencies have left it.
And
all the federal
still
agencies have left it.
Pretty recently, too.
Yeah, you're talking about
the last 5 years.
Border Patrol just switched to their Glocks within the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's been a huge shift.
Yeah.
And now everyone's like, oh, yeah, okay, we're going back to that. Mm-hmm. We're getting rid of our 40s, getting rid of our 45s, going back to 9s. Because of that, you know, of that shift. So these are the things where if you have something that's been beaten to your head, or you have something that you've just done it a lot for, you know, for many years, many months, whatever it may be, and you just don't want to let go of it, like, quit being married to the idea of concepts, techniques, equipment.
Because otherwise you're going to get left in the dust.
When I first started working with carbines competitively, I was like, I'm going to shoot iron sights because I'm a fucking badass. And so I started shooting iron sight, you know, ARs in the old school, you know, two-gun, three-gun matches. This is years and years and years ago. And everything was going actually pretty good. I was doing just fine, you know, my little peep sights. I was doing just fine. And then I did a low light match, and I couldn't see shit. And I struggle fucked my way through that match horribly. And someone was like, hey, dude, you should put a red dot on that thing. And I was like, but technology, and it fails. And I had this idea, right, because from some of the stuff I'd you know, seen in the military, like red dots failing and optics failing, and I couldn't afford an ACOG, which at the time I thought was a badass optic. And now I'm like, I wouldn't want an ACOG on any of my systems. It's garbage compared to other options that are available, right? Again, that's another paradigm shift. But I'm like, I can't really afford an ACOG, and a red dot's going to fail, just a dot, blah, blah, blah. Put a red dot on my gun, you know, I don't know, maybe a month later, and I've always had a red dot on my gun since. That shift in mentality. You can't be married to an idea. You have to be willing, you know, to change. You think now sites are interesting even. You know,
yeah, remember they used to have night sites, and now most people don't even rock night sites anymore.
Think about how night sites were just it was drilled into me when I got into, like, the civilian concepts of carrying a handgun concealed or whatever. It was, like, drilled into me by every instructor I went to, every competition I went to, everybody I knew. You got to have night sights on your gun. If you don't have night sights on your gun, you're not going to see your sights at night. Night times when you're most likely to get attacked, you're going to die in a gunfight. And so everyone's like, oh, my God, run out and put night sights. I don't even – I think I have one pistol now in the safe that has night sights on it, and it's only because – they're the best option for suppressor height sights because it's on one of the red dot pistols.
Yeah.
That's it. They don't give a shit about the red dot or the night sight option.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Can't see shit, so it doesn't freaking matter. So kind of a big shift in those sights, a big shift in how sights are even seen. You know, it used to be everyone was trying to figure out, like, what's the best combination of dots and dashes and horseshoes and all that. Now most of our sights are black on black, you know, black front post, black rear notch, and maybe we throw a fiber optic in the front, you know, to increase our visibility of the front sight in you know, bright light conditions. Other than that, the sights have changed. And look at how we're even designing our sights. Everything we used to want, sloped edges and, you know, easy for, you know, carry and concealment and all that. Now we want everything to have a sharp edge on it so we can work it, you know, single hand manipulation clearances and all that off of belts and holsters and vehicles and whatever else. So even how sights are set up, you know, has changed significantly on the handgun.
And I think
– go ahead.
Overall, I think it's just – the lesson learned here is that if you're not keeping up to date or even just trying to keep up with some of it, like maybe there's one or two things that you're like, yeah, but it works for me.
Yeah, like,
because that's what we always teach. You know, if it works for you, it works for you. But also don't be so naive to just be like, well, I'm not going to go out there and change. You know, I'm not going to do this different or do this different and do this different, because we've seen it. We've seen it at the range when we're teaching courses and we show somebody a new technique. All of a sudden, they're like, I'm so much faster. I'm so much faster to see my sights. I'm so much, you know, I'm shooting better, blah, blah, blah. Some people get into that thing where they are complacent and they're like, I'm good enough. You know, I'm good enough if I need to handle my stuff. But what if you could be better?
Yeah, what if you could be better?
Just doing a couple different certain things. Just, you know, it's the same thing. Well, my gear is good enough, or the stuff I have is good enough. But what if it could be better, because you're having outdated gear or there's outdated techniques? And then you also have to think of it from a different perspective, is what is your enemy going to have? Mm. You know, it's like that. What if he has the best updated things and techniques and he fucking smokes you because you were complacent with just being where you were?
Well, the idea of being good enough, I think, is I never imagine myself as being good enough to handle the majority of threats that I might come across, because the kind of things that I think about happening to me from a self-defense perspective, and folks, if you're in the military or law enforcement, this is actually something a conversation I was having when I was teaching those defensive tactics instructors on Monday, those law enforcement guys, was like, the biggest problem is all your techniques were built for compliant or semi-compliant people. And the majority of your force is used to compliant or semi-compliant people. And so then there's a certain amount of kind of bravado that builds up. Like, well, I've been able to handle myself up till now. I've been on the streets for 15 years. You know what I mean? I can handle myself. So I'm sure the techniques I work just fine. Yeah, until you come upon someone who knows what's up.
Yeah.
I mean, I disarmed every single cop in that class.
Yeah.
With force. Like, yeah. I wasn't like, okay, let me do this. It was like, no, you resist me as well as you can, and in a couple seconds, I'm going to be shooting you with your own gun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know the technique that you've used for years. I get it. I get it. How bad do they want your gun? Okay, you want to go to the floor? I'll go to the floor with you. That's fine.
Yeah.
Of course, I came home and I'd fucked up my shoulder, but that's another.
And your finger.
But I won. Yeah, I also smashed the shit out of my pinky, but after dude rolled over on it. But I won both times. That's the important part. But the idea is, like, that mentality, right, is it gets people in trouble. And that was a small class. It was only a few of these instructors. Not like I was in there with 20 DT instructors. I don't want to oversell what I was doing there. But just a few people. But the point is, like, their techniques and concepts were so based on compliant people and not non-compliant or even more so determinedly violent attackers. Yeah. And that's who I imagine. So when I'm thinking about my techniques or I'm thinking about, you know, my equipment or I'm thinking about what I'm going to be doing, to me, it's all about like I'm going to be going up against 300-pound Samoan dudes who've spent the majority of their, you know, adult life in prison and they're ready to fight and kill and murder. Like those are the people that I'm thinking about going up against because and then I'm like, my skills aren't good enough. My fitness isn't good enough. I'm not going to be good enough for that. So I need to ramp it up. I need to get better. I need to improve so that if it becomes that situation where I walk into and it's just some stupid crackhead in the parking lot trying to fuck with me and a shitty little plastic knife or something, I'm like, okay, I can handle this. But I don't want that to be the thing I've trained for. Oh, perfect. This is what I planned for. It's like, no, this is 5% of what I've planned for. Easy day, right? And these paradigm shifts have shown that. You know, even things like shifting to, you know, appendix. And I'm not an appendix carrier. I just haven't quite figured out how to make it work. And I've tried every gun and holster combination out there, trust me. But it is a superior position. Like appendix truly is a superior position from a fighting aspect. And I wouldn't even say it's been a shift like, oh, look what we've discovered. Like, dude, hundreds of years ago, people were appendix-carrying pistols. Cavalry officers in Civil War, pirates were appendix-carrying pistols. You know, like, since the beginning of pistols, people have appendix-carried pistols. It's not a new thing. But to really teach it and prove it in the way that we're doing it now, again, combined with entangling and combined with grappling and combined with, you know, BJJ and combined with the fighting concept of the pistol, really fighting with a pistol and with interpersonal violence in close quarters, how that's worked. And so that shift to, you know, more and more people now using appendix in waistband carry and things like that, it's a total shift in mentality where, again, 15 years ago, you weren't really seeing many people appendix carrying. And if they were, you're kind of like, what's with that weirdo? You know, it's like we couldn't contextualize it. Which also really makes you think about some of the stuff where you look now and you see stuff on people's guns. And you're like, what a weirdo that he's got that. Or, oh, what the hell is that all about or whatever. Look, man, you may not know what their context is. And you may not know how they're applying their situation. You may not know why they've got their gear, their kit, their truck, their whatever set up, however it is that they have it set up. My recommendation is if you see something new, fucking ask somebody. Like, hey, dude, why do you set your rifle up like that? And if they're like, because I saw it in the movie, then be like, okay, move along, right? No big deal. But if they're like, why do you set your rifle up that? And they go, oh, yeah, well, because of this, this, and this. Cool. It may not fit your context, but at least now you know. Things like nose to charging handle on an AR. You know, I was originally taught, like so many people, shooting an AR-15, you got to get up close on that, you know, peep sight. So it's nose to charging handle. Like literally get your nose as close to the charging handle as possible. And that's how you'll be able to get a full field of view through that tiny little peep sight. Whether you're using the large aperture or small aperture, it's still a relatively small hole. And that's how you're going to get the biggest field of view is by getting the nose to the charging handle. And then you're going to find a consistent cheek well and yada, yada, yada. That shit's gone. Now we've got red dots. We've got, you know, high-vis mounts. We've got, you know, two-inch mounts now and all that kind of stuff. We have entirely new concepts and techniques that don't matter anymore, right? We don't need to do that anymore. We don't need to put our nose to the charging handle anymore. But I still see people trying to do it. I'm like, hey, man, I know you probably have hundreds, if not thousands of hours of time doing that, but – you don't need to do that. Look at the optic that you have. You don't need to do – yeah, but it helps. No, it fucking doesn't. Like, yeah. It's not helping you. Don't do it and do it and tell me if there's a difference. You know what I mean? Do it 100 times and tell me which one is better. And if the nose of charging handle is still the best and awesome, do it. But I'm telling you it's probably not going to be – trust me, you know. Lights. You know, lights are another big deal. I just think about – years ago, how it was taught. I never taught this, all right, because I always thought it was horse shit. But other people would teach like, oh, you don't want too bright of a light indoors. You'll blind yourself and all this kind of stuff. And that shit never made sense to me. But it was a very big common thing that was being pushed out there. And everyone had these low yield lights. And I've always been of the mindset, having spent some time working in the dark and doing various different things in the dark, I'm like, why wouldn't you want to attach the power of the sun to your fucking flashlight? Like if I could harness the power of the sun and put it in my flashlight, I would absolutely do it. If I could burn the retinas off my opponent, I'm all for it, man. Like let's do it. Let's freaking do it. I'm all for it. Context of what I'm doing.
Right.
Right. So even that has changed significantly. And I would say, I mean, look, we could go on
forever.
All day. And there's, I've probably only gotten through about half this outline that was sent to us. And I tried to hit the most important ones. But here's one of the big things I can tell you guys. All right. I'll wrap this up with this story because I think it's an important story. Buddy of mine named Paul was in the Marines, big push into Baghdad back in 03. Back then, and I remember this technique well, 3 mag pouch on your LBE for anybody who knows what the fuck that means. You're old like me. 3 mag pouch, a little plastic clip on the front, flip open the plastic clip, 3 magazines held side by side. I always used to joke that the magazine actually only held 2.75 magazines, but we had to get 3 magazines in it, you know? And so you'd finally get them in there, right? And, you know, this was back in the day when the average Joe actually helped Magpul invent the Magpul, which was a piece of paracord that would just wrap over, you know, we'd slide them underneath the base on the floor plate or sometimes duct tape it to the side. So you would have a way – that's where the whole thing came from. So you could hook the paracord and pull the damn magazine out of the freaking mag pouch. Otherwise, you would not be able to get it out. It was impossible. It was just a pain in the ass. And then when we were done with – you know, after performing a reload, you would put the empty mag back in there because you wanted to retain your equipment. And so here's what happened based on it, on that tactic, technique, and procedure, the TTP that Paul did. Here's what happened to Paul. And Paul's story became kind of famous because of what happened after what happened to him. He was in a village and they came into some contact and he chased a couple people in the backyard of this this building. And one of them he got into a gunfight with. And I'm kind of summarizing the story here. And he ended up shooting the guy and the guy fell into a doorway into a building. And at this point, Paul realized he was out of ammunition. And so he did the classic reload. He fucking stood there. And he assessed his weapon. It was indeed out of ammunition. He withdrew the empty magazine. He looked down at his magazine pouch. He opened up the little flap. He wiggled that shit back in. He withdrew a fresh magazine. He looked it into the magazine well. He charged it with the charging handle. He looked up, and the guy was back up. By the time Paul looked up, the guy was back up into a firing position and shooting. Paul was AK-47. If I remember correctly, Paul was hit 4 times, 2 of which impacted his spine with 7.62x39 and crippled Paul from the waist down for the rest of his life. After all the stuff that, that he had to go through and get back, he got into a wheelchair and he got back into, you know, the lifestyle and everything. He went and took a class. Happened to be from the Magpul Dynamic folks at the time, I believe, Chris Costa and Travis Haley. And the part of the reason Paul's story became pretty popular is because what he said next. He said, basically, what I learned in the first hour or so of that class, I'd still be walking. Just fucking think about that for a second. Because what he learned to do was reload. It was like, hey, first of all, don't fucking stand there. Move your ass. Oh, look, it's empty. Yeah, get rid of that fucking empty. You can get it later if you need it. Grab the magazine, jam it in. Because contextually, you're in a fight, man. Get the gun running. Jam the magazine. Hit the ping pong paddle on the side. And get back behind those sights. Keep your muzzle oriented down towards the target. Don't drop the gun all the way down to your waist. Don't do what we were trained to do. That is what we were trained to do. That is how we were taught to reload a rifle.
Yeah.
In the context of everyone's on the line and there's 100 or 200 or whatever dudes shooting at the same time, it worked. But in the context of Paul being in the backyard, it didn't freaking work. And that quote always stuck with me. I remembered that because it was right around the time that I started teaching that he took that class and got this information and we shared this. He shared the story with me and others. And that's always stuck with me as an instructor about like the information I teach people. The information I bring to myself and to the people that I love could literally mean the difference between me surviving this and not.
Yeah.
Updated modern techniques were the difference between Paul being in the wheelchair for the rest of his life and not. Think about what you do. Are you being dogmatic about what you're doing in training, about what you're doing with your techniques? Are you scared to change? Are you scared of the failure that might come if you want to adapt or change? Please don't be. If you have any questions about this, email us, info@trainingaz.com. Don't be afraid to change. And we'll help you out. You got something you're like, is this the most modern way to do shit? I don't know. Am I doing it right? Yeah, fucking email us. We'll help you out. No problem whatsoever. Independence training moment. Single-handed shooting and the realities of it. Look, here's the facts. Most shootings, both law enforcement and armed citizen, begin single-handed. Not because your other arm is wounded at the onset of battle, but because it's tied up doing something else or previously injured before the event. Practice single-hand shooting. If I were you, I would spend 50% of your time doing it.
Yeah.
50% of your time should be taught, should be spent practicing your single-handed shooting. And that includes single-hand presentation from concealment and from other holsters. That is a reality. It's more than likely. In our studies, it's about 65% of the time it's going to start single-handed. It may not end single-handed, but it's going to start single-handed. Remember, you can bring us out to train with you. Get hosting information via email, info@trainingaz.com. Some of you guys have contacted me and then I haven't heard from you. So don't be scared. Don't be scared. Email us, and we'll make it as simple as we possibly can. Make sure you follow us on Facebook and Instagram as The Arms Room Show, Independence Training, Red Wire Gear, and MRC Phoenix, Drew's Running Group. We're proud members of the Heroes Media Group. Make sure you check out the other shows on the network. So many great shows and tons of other services. Tons of media services. So please make sure, if you guys are unfamiliar with the Heroes Media Group, they are the ones who've kept us on the air all this time, along with our wonderful patrons. Please make sure you check out Heroes Media Group. Next week, we're going to be talking about knowing your rights and applying them. Specifically, we're talking about the Bill of Rights.
Ooh.
Until next time, stay aware, stay safe, and train hard. You've been listening to The Arms Room.